Session number 9826, Reel 4.
Mr. Levine, Reel 4.
The idea was to cross over into Vichy France, where it was felt that life would be easy insofar as there'd be no Germans around. So, having got off the train at Tours, Albert made inquiries as to where the demarcation line was, and we started walking towards the Loire, because virtually the Loire became the demarcation line at that particular point. We were walking along a country lane towards a point which we had identified as a crossing. We had got across the Loire, but it was still on the far bank, it was still occupied by the Germans. And they were patrolling a roadway which really was the demarcation line at that particular point. So we were walking on a road parallel to this demarcation road, and we came across a French family. The family consisted of grandfather, grandmother, father, mother, daughters and sons, a gaggle of some 12 people. We caught up with them and Albert started talking to them. And I heard such words as pilot, and it seemed to me he was telling them that he'd got a British pilot with him, which I wasn't very happy about. But they all came over and shook my hand and were delightful people. And we walked along together, and it appeared that they too wanted to get into unoccupied France. So we came to a point where we were going to have to cross this road. And we could see this road on the other side of a wheat field, and we picked a point where, which was midway between two sentry stations. We then started to cross this field, and as we got nearer to the demarcation line, the road, we started crawling. Now, I should say that I tried to tell Albert that we didn't want these French people with them, that they were following us. And as we crawled, so they crawled. We had got within 150 yards of this roadway, and I had to look above the cornfield and saw the head of somebody about 50 yards away. So I said to Albert, somebody there. Now, amongst my escape kit, I was carrying a knife. It was a type of scout knife. It's a thing one used to carry in a Spitfire for another particular reason. That was, if your dinghy, which you were sat upon in the cockpit, happened to inflate by mistake, there was only one thing to do, and that was puncture it, otherwise you wouldn't be able to fly the aircraft. So I was carrying this knife, and Albert asked for this knife. So off he crawled. 10 minutes went by, 15, 20 minutes, and still no Albert. And I had visions of all sorts of things happening. So I crawled after this Albert, following his tracks through the cornfield, having told these French people to sit quiet. And there I found Albert sitting, drinking a bottle of wine and eating a French loaf with a French farmer. It was a French farmhand who had been in this particular field. And he was having a nice old chat and eat with him. So anyway, I pulled him away from there. And again, we said to these French people, do not follow us too closely. So we got to the edge of this field and we looked at the sentries and decided that their pattern of movement was typical Germanic. It was very, very consistent that they walked this way for 5 minutes and then stopped and then walked the other way. So we felt it was a reasonable thing just to run across the road, but we felt that we should do it one at a time. So I went first and Albert followed, and then to my horror, the whole of the 12 French people were started running across the road at the same time. But fortunately, luck was with us, and the Germans didn't see them. Well, we immediately got rid of the French people, French family, and walked on until we came to a farm. There, we were quite open and said, you know, British pilot, and could they help us? And the farm people said no, but they gave us a drink of milk and told us to get on our way. We walked into a little town and went into a bar and had a drink there, and Albert asked the landlord which way to the nearest railway station, something like that. And this fellow gave the indications and then disappeared. And I had a sixth sense about this. I looked outside, and at the end of the street I could see a gendarme coming out. So I said to Albert, I think we'd better go. So we ran off, and the gendarme belting after us, but we soon lost him. And we began to realise that it wasn't going to be that simple in Vichy France, because at least in the occupied France, you were pretty sure that the French people you met were genuine, because they wouldn't take a risk unnecessarily if they were associated with the Germans in any way. But in Vichy France, you couldn't be sure. There was the Quisling type over there. So anyway, we walked and we found a local train, and we got on the local train and finally picked up the main line going south. And by this time I told Albert that we ought to get off at Montauban. Well, Albert was very flamboyant, and he'd got the French francs that from my escape kit, and he bought a first class ticket on this train. Now, as I said before, I was dressed in these clothes of the 14-year-old, and they were a bit ill-fitting, and I felt very conscious of the burns and so on and so forth. And we sat in the compartment with a military personnel belonging to the French. I think he was a French aviator, but he could have been French Navy. Anyway, he started to talk to Albert and tried to talk to me, and I didn't reply. And he kept looking at me. And eventually, when we pulled up at Montauban and started to get out, he went to the window and called one of the station staff over and spoke to them. And we got off, and as we got to the ticket collector, this other French employee came up to the ticket collector and said something to him. And when we got to the ticket collector, he stopped us and must have asked Albert some questions, and Albert quite openly said to him, "English pilot." Well, in view of what had transpired with his conversation in the window, I was particularly scared, but instead of that, the ticket collector shook my hand and said good luck and let us through. So we went into town, and then I told Albert that the safe house was at a town called Negrepelisse, and that we should expect to get help there. And as far as I believed, it was either a monastery or something of that nature. So we went by bus on a roundabout way to Negrepelisse and found this address, and it was indeed looked like a monastery. So we knocked on the door, and they had the type of Judas hatch which opened and a face looked out. And I said, "RAF pilot, can I have some help?" The trap shut, and nothing happened. But again, looking up the street, within 2 or 3 minutes, we could see commotion up the end and the local police force turning out. So we took off in the opposite direction and eventually hid in a disused railway tunnel. Eventually, we made our way to walk back towards Montauban. We stopped at a farmhouse on the way, and we asked he asked the lady if we could have some food and shelter. And the husband said no, but we could sleep in the barn about 150 yards up the road. So we went up to this barn, and I just started to get comfortable for the night, and we heard footsteps up the ladder. We were in the hayloft, and it was the little boy who said that his mother wouldn't be able to sleep tonight, thinking of the poor young RAF pilot, and that we were to come back home and to have a meal and sleep in a proper bed. So we went back to this farmhouse, and she was absolutely charming, delightful. And so we slept there the night, and then the following morning we went back to Montauban. In Montauban we went to a barber's, had a haircut, and then we're wandering around, and we saw a queue of refugee type of people. So I asked Albert to find out what it was, and he said, oh, it's a soup kitchen for the Spanish refugees, because we were that far south at the influence of the civil war in Spain had affected that region. And even 4 years after the end of the civil war, they were still got soup kitchens for these refugees. So we joined in the queue to get a bowl of soup and a crust of bread. And as we got up to the serving area, I realized it was being run by scouts. So I gave the scout salute and spoke to one of the scouts in part English, part French, a few words that I could pick up, had picked up. And with the help of Albert, we asked if there was any English people living in the region, because we knew that in France a number of people had been trapped. So they said yes, there was an English lady here, married to a Frenchman, and he would try to contact them to see if they could give us any help, and that if they could help us, he would make a rendezvous on the bridge near there at 6 o'clock this evening. So at 6 o'clock that evening we were at this rendezvous on the bridge, and up rides a Frenchman on a bicycle and stops and speaks to me in perfect English and said, are you Jack? So I said yes. He said, well, Pat, my wife wants you to come home. So I said, well, I've got Albert with me. He said, all right, we'll bring him along. So we met Pat Charney, and she was absolute character. She, before the war, was quite a name in English golf. Her name was really Eleanor Maud Charney, which was her married name. And she was a real character, real British, the sort of person who would refer to the Germans as a bloody Bosch, that type of thing. She obviously came from a very good family. She was very concerned about it, but she wasn't very happy about Albert. So she said that she would put me up, but that she didn't want Albert staying in the house, but she would find a room for him in the local hotel. This she did, and I stayed with her for some 3 weeks, which must have put us by then towards the end of July. But early on, she was very concerned that I had been adrift now for some 5 or 6 weeks, and that my family must be worried. So she proposed that we send a telegram to my folks in England telling them that I was safe. So I said, well, you know, it's far too dangerous, we can't do that. But eventually she persisted and said it was perfectly safe, and we concocted a telegram which was fairly innocuous. She herself had had a child some 9 months before, Michelle. So that she said, well, we will just change it a little bit and we will notify your parents in such a way that it sounds like notification of a birth. So she sent the telegram which said, John arrived safely, all is well, Shalami. And then as a footnote we put on it, tell Anne. Now the reason we put tell Anne on was that at that particular time my girlfriend was called Anne, she was an American, lived in America, and that it would serve to be as an indication that it was a true telegram, because it was unlikely that a false telegram would know that particular piece of information. So ultimately this telegram went off and I thought no more of it. Well, after I'd been there about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, I'd said to Charles, look, I've got to get going, you know, my job is to get back to England. Now the only thing we can do now is the fact that in our briefing in England it is possible to cross the Pyrenees, and what you have to do is you have to go down to the Pyrenees and then find a smuggler, usually a Spanish individual, who continually crosses the Alps. He brings food, does all sorts of things, and get him to guide you through the Pyrenees until you get to Spain. Then you give yourself up to the police when you get into Spain, and they will eventually notify the consul at San Sebastian, who would pay a sum of money to the Spanish government and obtain your release. So that with this idea in mind, I said to Charles, well, that's about the only way I can get out. So he organised it that he got another bicycle, and we were going to set off early in August and ride down to the Pyrenees and there make the necessary arrangements. The day before we had scheduled to leave, and incidentally at their or Pat's suggestion I was going to leave Albert behind just in case, and that she said that providing Charles reckoned I got away okay, they would tell him, and if he wanted to try the same route, well, he could do so, or if he wasn't genuine, then he would just disappear. So anyway, the night before we intended to depart, there was a knock at the door, and I shot into my hidey hole because one was still a bit nervous, even though Pat was so easygoing about the whole affair. I mean, she used to send me out with the pram, walking Michelle around. Friends of hers got married at a church, and she insisted I participate in the ceremony, and that even I should sign the register of the marriage as a witness.
In whose name?
In my own name. So that, you know, she was such a character that she had no fear. But however, when this knock came, I went up to the hiding place, and I could hear a protracted conversation going on downstairs. And eventually she called to me and said, Jack, come down. And I found there a Greek-looking person, and he said his name was Mario de Prasinos. So I said, no, you know, hello. He said, well, he said, we've got a message from London that you were here. And he said, I've come to help you get away. So what had actually transpired was that When this telegram was sent, it went straight through to my home, wasn't picked up by anybody, and fortunately my brother was home on leave at that particular time, and by that time he had been commissioned in the army. And when he got this telegram, he said nothing. He said to my mother, you know, don't say anything to anybody, I'll take it to the War Office. So he took it to the War Office, and eventually it filtered through to the right department. That's MI9, is it?
Yes.
And things apparently started to happen. Apparently they got a radio message to the Patolliri line, which was then just in the stage of being formed. And it was Mario de Prasenos, who was involved in this line, who came and visited Pat Cheremy. Now, I have an awful lot of respect for their courage, because it could have been forced on either side. That is, the Germans could possibly have sent this message to England in order to trap somebody into exposing themselves on the Patolliri line, and vice versa. Pat could have been in trouble over the whole episode, but they took the risk, and the consequence was that this fellow arrived. He said, well, come on, we're off. So I packed up my toothbrush, which is about all I had, and we got on a train at Montauban, and eventually finished up at Nîmes in the south of France. There I was taken to a wholesale grocery store with a beautiful flat above it, run by a character called Gaston Negre, N-E-G-R-E. This was a safe house, part of the Patolliri organization. There I was fed well, had a wonderful time from the point of view of comfort and everything. But again, one ran across this peculiar quirk of individuals. The Gaston Negre, because of the fact that he held this wholesale grocery and provision store, had many friends in the right places, including chiefs of police and even Gestapo people, who he found that he could get favours out of for the sake of supplying a bit of food here and a bit of food there. And he had a theory, in keeping in with the Gestapo, they wouldn't realise that he was running on the opposite side at the same time. But his bizarre attitude came to a head one evening when he said, I'm having a dinner party tonight and I want you to be present. And I was at this dinner party, and the police, the chief of police was there and other characters, and I suspect members of the Gestapo. And we had this meal, and Gaston was roaring with laughter all the time, because he said to me afterwards, he said, I know they know. They know what I'm doing, but they don't say anything, or if their food supply is cut off. And there was this sort of blackmail element that was going on.
Were you speaking in any particular...
No, I was told not to talk, and that I was deaf and dumb. And if anybody asked me about papers, I had this Polish deaf and dumb identity card. But it just amused him to do this. But I also found out one morning that he wasn't all that he looked. He rather liked boys than girls. And one morning when he came into the bedroom and started stroking my leg, even at that age, I didn't know much about homosexuality then. But I knew it was not right, and you know, I pushed him away, and to his great credit, I mean, he never ever made any approaches to me. So I stayed there for some 3 weeks, and eventually Castelnegre appeared. Sorry, Mario de Prazenos appeared one fine day and said, right, we're off. So we took a train to Narbonne, which, as you know, is not too far from the Spanish border. There we got off the train, and we seemed to walk and walk and walk and walk. And eventually we ended up at a place called Canet Plage, which is on the coast just opposite Canet Plage near Perpignan. There we hid in the dunes, and bit by bit during the course of the day, other characters turned up, most of them Polish, but one other RAF officer. And believe you me, apart from talking to Pat Sheremy and her husband, to be able to talk to a compatriot in uniform or of the services again was quite something. Anyway, we stayed in these dunes until darkness fell, and then round about midnight, Mario got up and went down to the beach and called us all down there and flashed the light out to sea. And within a few minutes, there was an answering flash. And after about 10 to 15 minutes, a rowing boat appeared, a large rowing boat, and drew in onto the beach. And we all climbed aboard it and were rowed out to a trawler. So we got on board this trawler, and it was quite amusing there, because I was given a cabin, or rather given a bunk in the central area where there were two or three cabins. The fellow officer, or RAF officer, he was sent to bunk down with the seamen in the seamen's quarters. And afterwards they said, they thought it was a good thing. It was some quirk of these people on board, that they had more sympathy for NCOs than they did for officers on board. So anyway, we steamed off, and at dawn the next morning I was rasted out of the bunk and told to go up on deck. And once on deck, I was given a paintbrush and told to get painting. And they gave me a pot of grey paint and the brown superstructure with, you know, quite a lot of other people. We're busily painting away, painting out this brown superstructure and making it grey again. So that by the time we arrived down in Gibraltar again, we were a minesweeper. So we went into Gibraltar as a minesweeper. And apparently this boat, this trawler, converted trawler, used to come out of Gibraltar as a minesweeper, get out into the Gulf of Lyon, there get painted into its trawling colours, put out nets and drift up towards the French coast at various intervals, and then pick up people and take them back to Gibraltar. So eventually I got to Gibraltar, I was debriefed there. The officer was flown home the following day. I was kept there for about a week, because by that time I'd developed a few ailments, so living rough for quite a time.